Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have one of our most articulate, surprising guests, Gary Steingart, whose new book, Lake Success, has recently been published by Random House. It's really a good book.
Thank you.
What it seems to be about is someone who's done what they all did, became a business major at Princeton, became a banker, a hedge fund manager, a billionaire, and lost track of what he once cared about and once loved, as we all do anyway, but him especially. He's got an Indian wife, whose skin smells, I think, of honeysuckle. Even her feet, he tells us, or he thinks. Because the book begins in, what's the name of
that? The Port Authority of New York, the bus station.
The bus station.
Which doesn't smell of honeysuckle.
Which doesn't smell of honeysuckle, which smells of feet.
Of feet. And bad feet.
Bad feet. And he thinks, my wife's feet smell of honeysuckle. And, you know, he's facing the fact that, like Jack Kerouac and Sal, like Rabbit Angstrom, like many other American heroes, he's leaving home. He's leaving home. He's going to go traveling across America. He's going to take the Greyhound. He's going to leave behind his credit cards and his phone, but also his wife and his autistic child.
Yeah.
He's looking for his college sweetheart, Layla, who he also kind of left behind. So he's caught in a world between the walls of abandonment, and everyone is practically in a chorus telling him, you're soulless, you're heartless, all you have is an expensive collection of watches. Very beautiful, but what for? Okay, so who's Barry Cohn?
Who is Barry Cohn? Well, you know, researching this book required hanging out for about 3 years with hedge fund guys. There was no one single Barry Cohn. There were many people who seemed very dissatisfied with their lives, people who spent their days betting, because what a hedge fund really is, you make bets. They're not even called trades. They would say, I made a bet on this, I made a bet on that, and they'd be betting against others in the 0.01%, this very small clique in New York and Connecticut and elsewhere. And after they'd finished betting during the day, they'd go and play poker with each other. So the betting never ended. But all of it seemed to be a way to escape from the fact that all the youthful things they hoped for had not worked out. All the sparks of love and compassion and interest especially in the greater world had not worked out. Their world had shrunk to their apartment on the Upper East Side, their office in Midtown, their Hamptons house. And so in these 3 years, you know, I came in sort of thinking, well, hedge funds, these are not nice people. It wasn't that they weren't nice, it was that they were miserable.
On the road trip, on the Greyhound bus, after one of the inevitable rest stops, a very beautiful black woman gets on board. The whole bus goes silent. She's so beautiful. All the men on the bus are doing an internal mental, sit next to me, sit next to me. Who's she going to sit next to? The young ones who want to put the moves on her? The older ones who are going to try and buy her? No. She sits next to her hero, Barry Cohn. And he can't believe it. And what ensues is perhaps the craziest, most risky chapter in all of contemporary fiction, because if there's anything a white writer. Are we white writers, Gary?
Neo-Nazis might think otherwise, but I think I pass for white. Just a Jew, you know.
Yeah.
An immigrant, too. Jewish immigrant, Jimmigrant.
We're not allowed right now to write the chapter that you've written about Barry and this black woman. Her name is Brooklyn. Oh, boy, says Gary. But no, she's never been to Brooklyn. She's never been anywhere. She's never been on an airplane. This trip on the bus is around as far as she ever goes. And Barry is sitting there thinking, I want to take her on an airplane. I want to give her everything she's never had. He's someone with a heart buried so deep inside him that he thinks he owes everyone everything he would never have had if he hadn't become the hedge fund manager that he is. Mm-hmm. He wants to open a school for young drug dealers to learn how to operate expensive watches because he loves expensive watches.
The Urban Watch Fund, I think he calls it. And a lot of the hedge fund guys I met, you know, they had the idea that because they had succeeded in this very esoteric field and made billions off of a couple of bets and then also lost billions, that they were qualified to run education to, you know, well, look at our current government. You know, it's a bunch of people who came to wealth through dubious means and are now running public policy. And I think their ultimate goal is, well, I can make billions, but I can also change the way the New York City school system works, you know, which they can't.
This woman is, let me use the word, inappropriately cuddlesome. Mm-hmm. And my jaw was dropping because you were doing it so well. She knows who he is, and he doesn't know who she is. He sees her as an innocent. Why? Because he discovers that she goes to church regularly. Ah, church lady. Ah, but why? Why is she checking into the same hotel room with him, this church lady? Everything that you expect, the carpet keeps being pulled out from under you, and each of these characters turns out to be a more surprising, indefinable person than you thought when you first met them.
Yeah. In fact, the one person that is less surprising, I think, is Barry, because we know that his heart has been squished in by money to such an extent that, you know, it's very hard to hear it beat. But the goal of the novel is, at least by the end of it, you hear something. You can hear the ticking of his many watches, but you got to also hear the ticking of his heart. And with Brooklyn, you know, he starts off by saying something like, there weren't many African Americans in my field of work, you know, which is true. I've been hanging around with hedge funds. I've met very, very few, mostly white and Asian, I think, would be the two groups that are very well represented. And so, you know, so Barry has all these assumptions about her, and each one gets overturned piece by piece by piece.
Now, tell me, when you write something like that, do you know that you're walking on a gangplank?
I do, in a way. I mean, you know, And the main other character in this book, other than Barry, is Indian American, his wife. In Super Sad True Love Story, the previous character was one of the two main characters, Eunice Park, was Korean American. And, you know, I grew up in a world where, and to this day, you know, my wife is Korean American. I don't know that many white, you know, I don't know any Anglo-Saxons to write about. All my friends either belong to one of these groups or are at least Jewish, you know. So this is what I write about because it's what I know. If you ask me to cobble together a kind of middle-of-the-road Anglo-Saxon, you know, John Updike key character, I honestly couldn't do it.
But here we are at a different time when we're being told even that a man can't write about a woman, let alone a white man write about a black woman. And so you're taking big waddles into the middle of the dismal swamp where we're told we can have nothing to say because we don't know well enough.
Well, I think the key is to get to know people well enough to write about them. You know, I mean, that's the key. I think a lot of writing that you know is off tone is basically somebody projecting their ideas about what somebody of a different, of any different, I mean, it could be, you know, sexual orientation or gender, race, I mean, anything, even class, obviously. You know, you could tell that it's somebody who's almost cobbling together a bunch of, a character from, I don't know, a bunch of stuff she or he has seen in the TV or whatever. But for me, everything is very journalistic. If I don't spend time with characters, I mean, there is a kind of Brooklyn out there that I met. And I did not have, you know, the same kind of relations with her that Barry did. But I could almost sort of hypothesize what happened between a Barry-type person and a Brooklyn-type person based on meeting both types of peoples.
I'm talking to Gary Steingart, first of all, about his new book, Lake Success, a novel published by Random House. And I thought that that chapter was the most exciting, the best chapter in the book, because it was saying to me, Michael, look at how you're sitting up expecting him to take a fall. Look at how you're expecting him to swan dive or fall off the tightrope. I was sure that this chapter couldn't work today. And so I was reading it with great care, because this might be as difficult as some of the chapters in Huckleberry Finn for people to accept. We love Huckleberry Finn. We love Mark Twain for having written Huckleberry Finn, but it's become a subject for controversy.
Sure.
And here in Lake Success, I think that this relationship is more controversial than Barry's relationship to his autistic son. In what they call the autistic spectrum, that boy has succeeded well.
Quite, yes, yes. And strangely enough, somebody got in touch with me and said, is that based on my son? Because there's somebody who had a very similar journey to Shiva, who is the autistic son in the book.
Well, you know, since I've had the privilege of knowing people on every part of that spectrum, more or less, including the genius spectrum, geniuses who are so brilliant that they can't stop talking because they know so much more than you or I. They have so much more to tell us than we know we need to know. There's no point at which on the autistic spectrum where the autistic stops being autistic.
Sure.
It's always an extraordinary revelation of what it can be like to be human.
Absolutely, in a very different way to be human. And I think, you know, I think for somebody like Barry, who himself, I don't really diagnose him as being on the spectrum, but he's somebody who started out life not picking up social cues from peers. So he developed this idea of friend moves, where it's like a computer program from when we were young, you know, basic subroutines. If then, if somebody says hi, I say this, you know. So I think for him, you know, there's, and he's also, and his kid is nonverbal. So that puts another huge monkey wrench in the relationship.
He grew up, Barry did, looking at himself in the mirror, seeing if his moves are seductive enough to earn friends.
Well, I have to say this is something that I don't think I'm on the spectrum, but I grew up, you know, not knowing English, and so I spent a lot of time in the mirror practicing both English and hand gestures. You know, I grew up in the Soviet Union until I was 7, and so just trying to get that stuff right. So, you know, when you ask where did Barry come from, I think with every author, Barry also, every character you develop has something to do with you, obviously. Nothing is created out of whole cloth.
Nothing is created out of whole cloth. And you can't, I think you can't help it. You can write this character, Barry, better if your name is Gary.
Yeah, it's true. Well, that's why we switched that. You know, it's and whenever I write about people who have some real life equivalents, until the very last draft, I will use their name. Then I'll switch it out, because that's my way of remembering who they are and making sure that their personality infuses every line I write.
Of the books so far, it's the most saddened, it's the most melancholy book, it's the most, even though the characters are calling Barry, songless and heartless. It is a soullessness and heartlessness that he recognizes. Yeah. And as we read, we recognize it too. Yeah. And it's not that we feel sorry for him, but we want to send him a big wake-up message.
Yeah.
And feel that his, his schemes to fund the unfunded and educate the uneducated are not going to do as well as saying, hey, how are you this morning? Mm-hmm. What's your name? Mm-hmm. What are you doing out on the street this time with no place to sleep? Mm-hmm. You know, we all need to learn the dialogue. I mean, I'm living in a Los Angeles. You're living in a New York where people left and right have no place to go.
And I think, you know, I mean, Barry is in the 0.01%, but I think his malaise represents the malaise of all the middle and upper classes. I mean, in some ways, he just doesn't understand the world, and he's thrust into it. And here I use the narrative device of putting him on this Greyhound bus, but he's thrust into it. He flounders. He doesn't know quite what to do. The good stuff comes up, but all the bad stuff too. You know, and you mentioned Brooklyn. He goes through periods of loving her, but then worried that she's about to steal all his watches, which of course she doesn't do. So all
she seems to, but what she did sensitively was put the watches in the safe. He, thinking about what a black woman he doesn't know would do, never for a moment thinks she's saved his valuables. He thinks she stole my watches. And when he sees he's wrong, he sees he's not just wrong in this case, he's wrong all the time.
And he keeps saying over and over again, you know, I'm a Republican, but I'm socially liberal and fiscally conservative. That's his mantra. But at that moment, I think, with Brooklyn and other moments, the two kind of conflate, and you realize that being fiscally conservative in his case is not being socially liberal. It's actually being anything but. He conflates these two things, race and class and expectations, and it becomes a disaster for him. And I think he realizes at that point. But there's no, you know, I don't believe in full-on Hollywood-style redemption. I believe in incremental steps towards something and then steps back. You know, I think we're all on this endless escalator. We're trying to scramble up, and maybe we get halfway up or a third up or two-thirds up, or maybe we fall down completely. That happens to a lot of us, too. And I wanted Barry's journey to be this constant scramble up that escalator.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Gary Steingart about his book, Lake Success. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I'm talking to Gary Steingart about his book, Lake Success, a poignant tale of familial longing, an unsentimental ode to what really makes an American gray. He's also talked to us about Little Failure and the super sad true love story. This is a hard thing to pull off. When did you realize you were getting it?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm one of those writers who never thinks he gets it until somebody tells him it's okay. I have a feeling I'm getting it. And then I really rely on, I have a lot of friends whose work I adore, who read my own work and I read their work. And, you know, and so when I feel confident that it's not just me thinking I get it, then I move on.
Who are your top two readers, if you had to say?
It's really hard to say top two. I mean, I live upstate half the year, and I have some great readers there. Paul Lafarge, Rebecca Godfrey. She's just not upstate, but I love her commentary. Kathy Park Hong, the poet.
I like Paul Lafarge a lot.
Yeah, Paul Lafarge is terrific, yeah.
He's been on this show a couple times.
I bet.
He's a strange one.
He's a very, very dear friend of mine from upstate, and he always gets the first copy of all this stuff, and, you know, and he's good. I think he really nails it, so, in terms of...
Now, also, everyone now talks about the danger of nailing it. Is it okay to nail it?
In what sense?
What you said before, to offer too much redemption,
oh,
to get it too right.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, you know, I mean, everything is now so perfect that the idea of the messy novel disturbs people, and I think disturbs readers too, you know. Taking risks is tougher in literature, I would say, than it is in the other very big medium right now, which is TV. And I think you can do stuff in TV that you almost can't do in literature. And TV relies on a writer's room full of people with different experiences and different backgrounds. So there's many kind of checks and balances that go on in a writer's room. And sometimes TV gets it terribly wrong too. But, you know, when you're just sitting there and it's you and the mm-hmm. laptop, quality control is really up to you. And so it feels a lot dangerous. And I think I almost worry that people's expectations are of a nice, tidy package, whereas literature before used to be just this, you know, a consciousness explodes across the page.
Well, that's certainly true with the kind of book that, like, success is. If you think about Rabbit in the first Rabbit book, Rabbit Run by John Updike, when he goes out on the road, he really has left behind a dying child, a crazy wife, and he's throwing everything into the trunk of his car, and it's not much. Same thing, of course, with On the Road. In this book, Lake Success, what's interesting is that the character doesn't really take a risk. He's running away. He's abandoning people. He doesn't take a risk until he goes back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going back to the oasis of plenty mm-hmm. where he's not wanted.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good way to put it. Yeah, you know, and from the very first page, he says, the road's going to be welcoming. There's going to be pictures of a sort of thick woman who's going to serve him pulled pork and beans on the side of the road. And he's going to come up to her and say, hey, you know, you and me are the same, even though I have $2.4 billion under management. We're going to speak the same language. And she's going to offer to waive the price of the beans. And he's going to say, no, I'll pay for it, you know, and everything's going to be great. That's not what happens. But the fantasy of the road keeps him going for a very long time, even though none of the fantasy is fulfilled with anybody he meets. But the promise is there. I mean, this is the thing about America as opposed to many other countries. This is huge. So you keep thinking it's just around the corner. I'm going to keep going. All right. It didn't work out in Idaho. Montana's next. Oh, man, that's going to be great. Okay, not Montana. All right, let's try Wyoming. Holy crap, this is really going to work out. And so we create for ourselves this idea of multitudes. I mean, going back to Whitman and beyond.
I'm the grandchild of immigrants.
Yeah.
You are yourself an immigrant.
Yeah.
And the child of immigrants.
Yeah, both.
Yes. And does that state of hopeful expectation still exist?
In 2018, it's hard for it to exist.
Yes,
in this
so
country,
too.
It's very hard for it to exist because the masks have been pulled off. And
the masks have been pulled off.
We know what it. I mean, we always suspected what it was. I mean, but now it's here. You know, I mean, Barry has a scene where he's on the bus and these white supremacists get up and start talking about crucifying Muslims and Jews and that was journalism. I mean, I was on the Greyhound, and that's what they did. And we were passing through Grambling State in Louisiana, a historically black college, and one of them said, yeah, they got their schools. One day we'll have ours. And, you know, I thought, schools with white people? Yeah, there's a novelty of, you know, look up Dartmouth. I mean, you know. So almost everything that happens to Barry happened to me, in a sense. So this is a kind of inventory of 2016, the year where all of the masks fell off. And when I started the project, you know, I thought Trump was going to be a flash in the pan. And I thought, well, he'll be an interesting he'll kind of be this framing device. Well, it happened in this crazy summer, but for a second we thought that a man that most New Yorkers think is an idiot is going to be the president. And then, of course, by the end of the journey, I thought, oh, my God, this is those people on the bus are now the people in the government, the white supremacists that I met in Louisiana or Mississippi, you know. So that made it even more poignant and scary for me.
So now help me. The masks have fallen off. What do we do? Leave them off? Think of new masks?
This is the thing. This
live without masks? Can you?
You know, I am not... As a writer, I can diagnose what's happening. I can say the masks are falling off. I cannot come up with a coherent strategy right now in 2018 for what to do. Many of the writers I love, I'm not comparing myself to any of them, but once they started becoming the great, great writers, once they started figuring, not just describing the condition, but figuring out, going into their laboratory and mixing the penicillin with the, you know, whatever, sage root and beetroot and whatever, and trying to figure it out, those were not good works, and they did not contribute very much, you know.
Yeah.
So I will just say this is the problem, and God help us. We got to find, I don't know. I mean, is it our generation? How did we screw up like this? I mean, in a sense, you know, this is, we did this. I have a little kid, and I look at him, and I'm like, I'm sorry, you know.
And what are we going to do to make books relevant to the relevant questions?
And I think there is a kind of, the inability to focus on long texts is part of the problem. There's no question about it, you know. Super Sad was sort of about that. It was sort of a opening salvo in that idea that books don't matter, and then it was a, you know, social media-driven society that led to a kind of crypto-fascism. You know, I published that in 2010. I thought it would take us 20, 30 years to get there. We're here, you know. 6 years later, we were already there. And that's, I'm not even saying, I mean, I think part of it is I grew up in an authoritarian society and I have little, I just have an advanced kind of dolphin-like radar about this stuff.
Maybe what we need is for you to write an anticipatory prophecy, a work of great optimism, and maybe we'll catch up to you with that too. Wouldn't that be good?
I wish it was in my DNA, you know. I wish optimism came to the Ashkenazi Soviet immigrants. Yeah.
I've been talking with Gary Steingart, author of Lake Success, published by Random House. Thank you, Gary, for joining me.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, you can listen on demand with KCRW's own smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Susan Orlean is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.